Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Things are sounding more serious as Washington tries again to head off a government shutdown. The president sounded the alarm before reporters today.
You don't want delays. You don't want disruptions just because of usual politics in Washington.
And already the next budget battle is shaping up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rates CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. And by Chevrolet, undertaking a carbon-reducing effort, investing in projects like wind farms and planting trees across America over the next few years. ChevyCarbonReduction.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. We're glad to have you making us a part of your Tuesday, this 5th of April. We haven't even resolved the cliffhanger over this year's budget, but the increasingly urgent negotiations to avert a government shutdown didn't stop Congress from turning to next year's budget. Republican Paul Ryan chairs the House Budget Committee, and today he proposed a blanket plan to slash spending by more than $6 trillion over the next decade. Much of the savings would come from health care programs for the elderly and poor, Medicare and Medicaid. At the same time, the plan would cut the top rate for income taxes for individuals and corporations to a cap of 25%. Our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explores how Paul Ryan's budget can be so heavy on spending cuts and tax cuts.
Earlier this year, the President's Deficit Commission recommended higher taxes to cover growing health and retirement benefits for an aging population. Ryan was a member, and he voted no on the commission's final recommendations. At today's budget unveiling, he said higher taxes would only slow the economy.
If you tax something more, you get less of it. If you tax something less, you get more of it. We don't want to tax jobs more. We don't want to tax investment more. We don't want to tax small businesses and entrepreneurs more. We want them to be taxed less so we can get more of them.
Another Deficit Commission member, Alice Rivlin, says that by rejecting tax increases, Ryan's plan cuts too deeply into spending.
I believe that we need more revenues. We can't cut the entitlement programs enough in the face of this demographic tsunami to get by with no additional revenue.
The Ryan budget cuts top income tax rates for individuals and corporations by nearly a third, and it calls for getting rid of unspecified deductions and loopholes. Tax Policy Director Michael Linden at the Center for American Progress thinks he knows which ones.
The biggest ones are the mortgage interest deduction, the state and local tax deduction, the charitable deduction. These are things that benefit the wealthy, but they also really benefit the middle class.
Linden says Ryan's tax breaks are the reason Medicare, Medicaid, and other government programs have to be radically slashed in his budget. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On to more pressing matters in Washington. President Obama ticked through a list today of those who could be affected by a federal shutdown that's looming by the end of the week.
Whether you're a veteran or you're somebody who's trying to get a passport or you're planning to visit one of the national monuments or you're a business leader who's trying to get a small business loan.
Not to mention the federal workers who won't get paid. They're watching this wrestling match with hopes that they won't have to wrestle their bills without a paycheck. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Margaret Curtis is a meteorologist at a National Weather Service office in Maine. In a shutdown, she's considered essential. She'd have to go to work.
I could even be at work and not getting paid, and my landlord still needs a rent check, regardless of what's going on with the federal government.
Curtis has only been on the job for 4 months. Stephen Snodgrass has worked for the federal government for 19 years. Now he's with the Air Force. He remembers the last shutdown in 1995. Back then, he was certain he'd get retroactive pay, and Congress did eventually authorize it. But he says this Congress is different. He thinks that reflects a change in public attitudes. He says he's never seen such hostility.
I'm embarrassed almost to say I work for the government because there's this idea that we're lazy and, more importantly, I think that we're taking their tax dollars.
Snodgrass and Curtis say if there is a shutdown, they'll live off their savings. Federal workers with little or no savings turn to people like Joan Moran. She heads a credit union for Labor Department workers. The main branch is in the Labor Department building. It would close during a shutdown. Moran has already crossed that hurdle.
They are letting us come into the building. We won't open the branch because there'll hardly be anybody in the building, but we'll be there for phone calls, answering emails, taking loan applications.
The bank will offer loans with no interest for 6 months, but there's a $29 overdraft fee if Uncle Sam's strapped workers put too much on their debit cards. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The Federal Aviation Administration made it official this afternoon. It's ordering airlines to take a close look for hairline cracks in their most heavily used older model Boeing 737s. This following the hole that opened up in the fuselage of a Southwest flight on Friday. The FAA says the complicated inspections must be completed within the next 5 days. Southwest says it's now wrapped up its voluntary inspections. Some airlines tried to push through a new round of price increases in the past few days, but Southwest decided not to go along with the rest of the pack. The free market keeps fare hikes in line, and it seems for the moment further increases have been dodged. But for how long? Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
If you're buying a plane ticket this week, you should thank Southwest that the fare isn't higher. When most U.S. airlines, including United, Delta, and U.S. Airways, tried to raise fares last weekend, it was Southwest's refusal that caused all the others to draw back. Mike Boyd is an airline industry analyst. He says that's how it works.
One airline tries to raise fares $5 across the board. If others, you know, pick up and do it, then it sticks. If nobody does, it goes back again.
But whether you noticed it or not, airlines have been raising prices steadily for the last couple of months. Boyd says fares are about 9% higher than they were a year ago, and he thinks they'll be about 9% higher again a year from now because fuel costs have gotten prohibitive for the airlines.
There's not a single airplane flying in any airline fleet that was designed with $30 a barrel oil in mind, let alone $108 a barrel. So they're going to have to raise fares, they're going to have to raise the cost of flying, or they're not going to be in business.
There are different ways to do that. Raising fares is one. Charging more for extras is another. George Hamlin is an airline industry analyst in Virginia. He says if things get bad enough, the airlines will just cut capacity again, either by flying smaller planes or by cutting routes altogether.
What it comes down to is consumers will simply see fewer seats to buy, and then that's pretty simple supply-demand. If there are fewer seats, the price is likely to go up.
And unfortunately for travelers, even if the price of oil comes down again, Hamlin says it's unlikely fares will drop. He says the best you might hope for are some good sales. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
We have a correction. Yesterday in the numbers, we got Katie Couric's status at CBS News wrong. No decision has been officially announced about whether she'll stay as anchor. A change in the way much of Wall Street does business caused a bit of a stock market scramble today. Details coming right up, along with the fallout when we do the numbers. Here's a question to ponder. Scale of 0 to 10, 10 being a state of rapture. How happy did you feel yesterday? The British government wants to compile regular official assessments along those lines, so it's knocking on the doors of hundreds of thousands of households across the UK. Our series, Economy 4.0, explores ways to make the financial system better serve more people. Today, special correspondent David Brancaccio looks into whether a well-being index has a place in the cold, hard world of financial statistics.
First, let's address a prejudice. Isn't measuring happiness all a bit mushy? British Prime Minister David Cameron was questioned about this when he called for the new British happiness assessment last November.
If I thought this was woolly and insubstantial, I wouldn't be bothering on a Thursday morning when I've got lots of other things to do. I've got the Swedish Prime Minister turning up for lunch. I wouldn't be bothering with it.
Cameron, a conservative, says measuring progress is not just about how the economy is growing. It's how lives are improving to create, quote, a more family-friendly country. As for happiness equals fluffiness, some academics now prefer subjective well-being, or SWB, to confer gravitas. Nick Marks is founder of the Center for Well-Being at the New Economics Foundation.
You can call it positive mental health, you can call it subjective well-being, you can call it happiness, you can call it flourishing. Really, we're talking about the same thing. How are people's lives going? Are they able to do the things they want to do? These are important, critical issues for people. It is about our very lived experience.
Marx was a driving force behind the Happy Planet Index, which ranks countries based on sustainable environmental indicators. And he has a Kindle iPad-type book called The Happiness Manifesto.
Our best hope is over the coming years that, like politicians are judged on unemployment, inflation, GDP, that they start to get judged on well-being. It's actually how people hold them to account.
Can we bring rigor to what is measured?
Well, academics have been asking questions in this area for the last 30 years, and mental health surveys are very well respected in public mental health, and well-being ones are really just flipping those questions the other way and asking about the positives.
So, starting this month, Britain's Office for National Statistics is adding four well-being questions to its pre-existing national survey of 200,000 people that already asks about everything from smoking to retirement planning. I take the questions and try my own survey of one household, a three-room flat in North London overlooking a tidy English garden.
Overall, 0 to 10, to what extent do you feel the things you do in your life are worthwhile?
I'm a fairly sanguine and optimistic person, so I would say 8 on that.
Jane Muncaster is an archivist for the City of London.
Yeah, 8.
And your job's okay?
Job is good. We're facing pay restraints here in the UK at the moment, so that's a bit of a challenge, but my job is very interesting.
Other questions include, how happy were you yesterday? She says 7. How anxious? 3. Muncaster says government policies have a lot to do with her sense of well-being. She mentions national health care and the promise of a government pension. In fact, the biggest doubt about the Happiness Project is whether it will go beyond measurement and actually shape new policies.
It almost feels like a cruel joke.
Gail Cartmail, the number two person at Unite, Britain's largest labor union, says her government's track record is more about the pain of budget cutting.
How can we talk about measuring happiness when over 1 million jobs are going to be knocked out of our economy due to the financial decisions made by this government? That's 600,000 public sector jobs, 700,000 private sector jobs.
Britain's statistics office clearly has a lot of work to do. Paul Allen is in charge of the project.
Our aim is an accepted and trusted set of statistics, and I think to get that acceptance, to get that trust, we've got to demonstrate that we aren't embarking on a political agenda, but treading what is quite a tightrope, because we want these data, we want these statistics to be used by policymakers, by politicians, as well as by the public.
The first results from how people answered the four well-being questions are expected in the fall, with a regular happiness index, not until next year. In London, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
You can take a look at how the British public responded online to what makes them happy. That, along with other ways that might make the economy better serve more people, just find your way to David's Economy 4.0 blog at marketplace.org. If you own shares of Apple, Microsoft, or Starbucks, or let's say you have a growth fund in your 401k, you might be interested in something that the NASDAQ announced in the dead of night. It's making several changes in something called the NASDAQ 100 Index, and the market was abuzz today. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore is here to tell us about that. Hello, Heidi.
Hi, Bob.
First off, I think it would be helpful for us to be clear on just what is the NASDAQ 100 Index.
Sure. It's one of the gauges of how NASDAQ stocks are doing. It's not the NASDAQ composite, which everyone hears about and which we talk about every day in the numbers roundup. The composite index includes every single stock on the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ 100 is a basket of the most important non-financial stocks, the Apples and Microsofts and Oracles and Intels, the heavyweights.
Okay, then. So what are they doing to the NASDAQ 100 that made Wall Street sit up and take notice today?
Well, the NASDAQ 100 tries to balance this basket of important stocks based on the size of the companies. So Apple stock has quadrupled in value over the past 2 years, so it was about to tip the basket over. It was like a giant ostrich egg in a basket of chicken eggs. Here's how Josh Brown, a financial advisor, described it.
You had this stallion of a stock, Apple, making up 20% of the index all this time, and Apple has really done nothing but go up. The price has grown to the point where it was almost completely dominating the day-to-day moves in the NASDAQ.
So the NASDAQ had to perform what Brown calls reverse Darwinism. You can call it punishment of the fittest. So now NASDAQ wants to rebalance that basket. They'll reduce the shares of 82 stocks, including Apple, Starbucks, and Qualcomm. But that means that some stocks will get a bigger share of the basket, like Microsoft and Oracle.
So they're changing the way they measure these stocks, but changing the mercury really shouldn't change the numbers. Does this actually change the fundamentals at these companies?
Not really. It may change the value of your 401k, but Apple or Microsoft aren't better or worse companies than they were yesterday. Their stock prices are going to change anyway. A lot of mutual fund managers track the NASDAQ 100. In fact, about $330 billion of mutual funds base their investments on this index. So then they have to buy stocks like Microsoft, Oracle, and Intel and sell stocks like Starbucks or Qualcomm to keep up with the changes, and that's going to affect the stock prices. But all of that will officially happen on May 2nd, so we have some time.
Stay tuned. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore keeping us up on the changing game on Wall Street. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob.
Coming up, education and the law of supply and demand.
We actually were pretty surprised that a fair number of the students and their families didn't even want the glasses.
Freakonomics Radio is back, but first, let's do the numbers. Those plans to rebalance the NASDAQ 100 carried some weight today on Wall Street. The broader NASDAQ composite rose less than 0.1% or 2 points to close at 2791. But the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell a fraction of a percent, 6 points to close at 12,393. The S&P 500 was flat at 1332. Tech stocks were busy on an otherwise slow day. Intel chipped up more than 1%. Microsoft clicked up nearly 1%. Cisco gained about the same. Apple, whose influence will diminish in the NASDAQ, rejiggering, shed 0.2%. Retail shares rang up big gains. Abercrombie & Fitch muscled up more than 10% after projecting a strong year. Retailers may not be thrilled by this news, though. Demand for gasoline dropped more than 1% from last week, according to a report from MasterCard Advisors Spending Pulse. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.48%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted mail. Reputation.com. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday.
A Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs subcommittee examines the role of accountants in preventing another financial crisis. A House committee on livestock, dairy, and poultry holds a hearing to review the state of the beef industry. And how can we get to Mars? A two-day conference looking at how the International Space Station might help us begins tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. There were no numbers from the markets in China today. They were closed for the annual tomb sweeping festival. It's a time set aside for relatives to go and clean off the graves of their ancestors and loved ones. Nice thought, but many people are too busy to bother. Which is another way of saying there's a business opportunity. Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz has our story.
In today's China, you can pay someone to do nearly anything for you. Sweeping grandma's tomb is no exception. That's what Chen Yifan does.
Clients call me with the address of the cemetery, and I'll go there with cleaning supplies, some flowers, and I'll prepare whatever offerings they want. Then I'll record the whole thing and send them the video.
Chen and his staff of 10 tomb sweepers have fielded hundreds of calls in the past few days for his services. He charges up to $100 per client.
Tomb sweeping seems a bit meaningless to young professionals. They're just too busy to do this. They'd rather visit their ancestors' graves on their own schedules.
At a cemetery in Shanghai, a woman cries at the tomb of her husband while her shaking hands prop up traditional offerings of fruit and candles for him. Nearby, Zhang Wei says the idea of people hiring others to do this disgusts him.
That's terrible. It's an empty gesture. It would be okay if you were abroad. You could ask your relatives to visit the grave and pay respects for you, but paying a stranger to do this is awful.
And with that, someone sets off fireworks to scare any bad spirits away from their ancestors. A pyrotechnic rebuke to those working at the office buildings nearby, too busy to pay their ancestors a simple visit. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Time for the folks who always seem to uncover the hidden side of just about everything. The strain on budgets is squeezing education spending, and that's bound to put a premium on innovative, or shall we say cheap, fixes to teaching problems. Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics always has his eyes open for these sorts of solutions. Today, he's sharpening his focus on a surprisingly simple solution to an education problem in China.
Gansu province, about 1,000 miles west of Beijing, is mostly rural and very, very poor. So, for a kid growing up there, a good education is important. Here's an eighth grade teacher in Gansu named Long Qingyi.
Sometimes I have to call the students up to the blackboard in order to read. And other times I just have to walk over to the students myself to give them extra attention.
As classroom problems go, this is as basic as they get. It's tough to learn if you can't see the chalkboard. An estimated 10% of primary school students in the developing world need eyeglasses. But an academic study in Gansu found that of students who need glasses, only 2% had them.
Well, I think that was obvious when we visited schools.
That's Albert Park, an economist at Oxford. He and Paul Glevy, an economist at the University of Minnesota, set out to fix what seemed like a pretty straightforward problem.
We explain that we're going to provide them with free eyeglasses, and then we have to, of course, get the permission of their parents and get their own agreement to participate in our program and to accept the glasses.
Park and Glevy were going to hand out eyeglasses to 1,500 students. Each pair cost just $10 to make, and because the researchers had grant money to work with, the glasses were totally free for the kids. But it wasn't just a goodwill mission. It was also an educational experiment. Park and Glevy set up a control group of another 1,000 students nearby. After one school year, the kids with glasses had learned 25 to 50% more than the control group. There was just one wrinkle. A lot of kids who needed glasses wouldn't take them.
We actually were pretty surprised.
462 families turned down free glasses for their children. Why? It's hard to say exactly. Some parents thought that glasses might make their kids' eyes weaker, which most optometrists say is a myth. Others might have been wary of a handout from Western academics. And then there's the old four-eyes stigma. Regardless, Park and Glevy learned something interesting. Here was an education reform that was simple, cheap, and it worked. It was also unusual because instead of addressing the supply side of education, this addressed the demand side.
I think that a lot of the people going around trying to think, how can we improve education and learning, tend to focus on how we can improve schools and teachers or textbooks, etc. And this problem is a little bit different because it's really about the behavior of students and their parents.
Park thinks more families would have accepted the glasses if the researchers had better explained the program, if they had cultivated demand. So how do you make having four eyes cool?
In America, eyeglasses are the coolest thing you can put on your face right now.
He would say that. That's Harvey Moscot, an optometrist and president of a New York eyewear institution called Moscot. Every year, Moscot sells about 300 pairs of vanity glasses with clear plastic lenses for about $225 a pop. In the industry, they're called Planos. According to one estimate, some 4 million Americans wear Planos every day. Not to see better, just to look better. I asked Moscot why there's such a difference in eyeglass culture between the U.S. and Gansu province.
Famous Chinese icons probably are not wearing their glasses like they are in America. Any hip-hop star to any idol of a sports star that wears them influences children's perception of eyeglasses.
You hear that, Chinese celebrities? Please, put on some eyeglasses. Hey, I wear mine every day. I'm Stephen Dubner for Marketplace.
Stephen Dubner is our Freakonomics correspondent. There's a weekly Freakonomics radio podcast you can subscribe to on iTunes. Dubner will be back here 2 weeks from today.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. Is supported by Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And a final note, call Charlie Sheen what you want, but one thing for sure, he's enterprising. There's word that a company with ties to the actor has filed trademark applications for 22 of his now famous sayings. Picture a slot machine with the catchphrase, duh, winning, or a drink mix with tiger blood or Adonis DNA. And someday it seems that, yes, there could even be a bra to make any woman one of Sheen's goddesses. I'm telling you, you can't make this stuff up. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 6 points, a fraction of a percent. The Nasdaq rose 2 points, less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 ended right where it started. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas of our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, been to the store lately? Why food prices are on the way up across the globe.
Food is one of those things that just responds very quickly because everybody has to eat.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us back here for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.